Chapter 15. Sacred Geometry. From the time of its earliest appearance in the archaeological record, which is absolutely not the same thing as the time that it first took shape, Amazonian civilization is a continuum that does not break from the wisdom and insights of its founders. The same basic principles defining the relationship between humanity and the cosmos continue to manifest and to be re-expressed over thousands upon thousands of years, in some cases evolving and developing into strange new growths, in others devolving and decaying. But just like that enigmatic Australasian genetic signal still found among Amazonian peoples today, other traces of ancient and mysterious connections, though faint, have also survived. For example, despite rejecting the old stereotypes of the savage and primitive Amazon, and despite knowing that prehistoric civilizations of some complexity had once flourished there, scientists at the beginning of the 21st century were nonetheless taken aback to be presented with overwhelming evidence of an ancient practice of geometry in the rainforest, and on a very ambitious scale. Let's get one thing straight before we take a closer look at this mystery. Just because people live in a dense jungle and haven't attended math classes in high school does not mean they have no grasp of geometry, one of the deepest and oldest products of human reason. On the contrary, though often wrongly attributed to Euclid, there is compelling evidence, mysterious in itself, that the conceptual principles of geometry are inherent in the human mind. This evidence comes from an isolated region at the heart of the Amazon, where scientists from the Cognitive Neuroimaging Unit of the Collège de France led a study in which the indigenous Munduruku people were tested on basic geometry skills. The study found that Munduruku children and adults spontaneously made use of the core concepts of topology, for example, connectedness. Euclidean geometry, for example, line, point, parallelism, and right angle, and basic geometrical figures, for example, square, triangle, and circle, and they use distance, angle, and sense relationships in geometrical maps to locate hidden objects. In summary, therefore, isolated peoples in remote parts of the Amazon today, whose contact with technological civilization is extremely limited, possess innate geometrical knowledge and are able to deploy it independently of instruction, experience with maps, or measurement devices. No doubt their ancestors, and probably most humans always, have been blessed with the same neurological gift. Indeed, we see it made manifest down the ages in all kinds of man-made structures. Even the simplest wattle and daub hovels tend to be rectangular or square rather than randomly shaped. Likewise, from England's Stonehenge to the Great Pyramid of Egypt, to India's Madurai Meenakshi Temple, to Borobudur in Indonesia, to Angkor Wat in Cambodia, to Tikal in Guatemala, to Tiwanaku in Bolivia, and to countless other sites too numerous to mention, the design of the sacred architecture of the world is entirely governed by geometry. The very universality of this geometry, as an innate faculty of the human mind, is not in doubt. But how it has been expressed by different civilizations in different epochs is culturally driven. Thus, Angkor Wat is not the Great Pyramid, and the Great Pyramid is not Stonehenge. All three, however, share the same fundamental geometries and connections to the cosmos that, I have long argued, were incorporated into a system of architecture central to the beliefs and lifeways of a lost civilization of remotest prehistory. When that civilization was destroyed in the series of cataclysms that brought the last ice age to an end, there were survivors who took the system with them, seeking to replant it in many different parts of the world where they found refuge. In some, it took root and flowered early, and over thousands of years it manifested in multiple different ways. In others, it lay dormant for millennia before bursting into exuberant life. Mainstream archaeology recognizes no such universal system, nor even the vestiges of one, and insists that there was no diffusion of ideas between these ancient cultures. How could there be, when Angkor is 3,500 years younger than the Great Pyramid? The point is fair, but irrelevant to my proposition, which does not require diffusion within the past 5,000 or even the past 10,000 years. Instead, I suggest that the similarities and differences between certain ancient monumental structures created around the world at different times by different cultures are best explained by a remote common ancestor civilization that left a legacy of ideas and knowledge in which they all shared, which their priests, shamans, and sages sought to preserve, and which they in due course deployed in their own different ways. One of the hallmarks of this worldwide system, whether its widespread presence is coincidental or not, is geometry. And in turn, whenever the geometry manifests on a monumental scale that could only be achieved by skilled specialists and a large, well-organized workforce, the obvious implication is that a fairly advanced civilization must have been involved. That was why, when giant geometrical earthworks were discovered in the Rio Branco area of the Brazilian state of Acre in the southwestern Amazon in 1977, nobody at first paid much attention. This was the era when the Smithsonian's Betty Meggers still reigned supreme over all things Amazonian. Her Man and Culture in a Counterfeit Paradise had been published just 6 years before, and her view that the jungle could never have supported large populations or any form of civilization capable of monumental architecture was the full-blown dogma of the day. Little wonder, then. Although the Smithsonian had sponsored the National Program of Archaeological Research in the Amazon that found the first geoglyphs, that it did not announce the discovery until 11 years later. The young man who actually spotted the earthworks from a Smithsonian survey aircraft was Alcheu Ranzi, and it was he who named them geoglyphs. His career took him elsewhere for the next 2 decades, but his interest was sparked again after another overflight in 1999. And now at the Federal University of Acre, he resumed his research, together with colleagues Denise Shan of the Federal University of Para and Martti Parsinen of the University of Helsinki. Their first detailed results were published in the December 2009 issue of Antiquity, which trailed the findings as evidence of the existence in ancient times of a sophisticated pre-Columbian monument-building society in the upper Amazon basin on the east side of the Andes. This hitherto unknown people constructed earthworks of precise geometric plan, connected by straight orthogonal roads. At the outset of the paper, Ranzi, Shan, and Parsinen described clusters of these monumental earthworks, mostly located on a 200-meter-high plateau. Formed by excavated ditches and adjacent earthen walls, the earthworks are shaped as perfect circles, rectangles, and composite figures. But why had these stunning Amazonian geoglyphs first been noticed only a few decades previously? Ranzi and his colleagues observe that while the geoglyphs were abandoned about 500 years ago and then heavily overgrown, they have since been revealed by mass clearing of the forest for the cattle industry, thus becoming visible, especially from the sky, over the past 30 years. Indeed, the enormous size of the geoglyphs makes it easier to distinguish their shape and configurations from an aerial perspective than at ground level, and satellite imagery has been made freely available to researchers by Google Earth. Nazca Amazon connections. To the extent that they are best seen and understood for what they are from the air rather than from ground level, comparisons with the famous Nazca lines of southern Peru were inevitable, and quickly began to be made, particularly so since, in addition to its giant images of animals and birds, the Nazca Plateau also features many precise geometrical figures. Ranzi himself has invited the comparison by asserting that the Amazon geoglyphs are as important as the Nazca lines. And indeed, his own use of the term geoglyphs was, according to his colleague and co-author Denise Shan, inspired by the figures on the Nazca Plateau. This, Shan argues, is unfortunate because the Nazca lines are a different phenomenon. In the Nazca Desert, geometric and zoomorphic figures were shaped by the displacement of dark weathered rocks on the surface to expose a lighter subsurface. In Brazil and Bolivia, however, the figures were produced by the excavation of large continuous ditches forming circles, rectangles, hexagons, octagons, and other non-geometric shapes. I'm not persuaded by this distinction. Whether a painter uses oils or watercolors, the end result is still a painting. Likewise, although different techniques and materials were used, unavoidable given the very different environmental conditions of the Amazon and at Nazca, the end result in both cases is still a canvas, decorated with immense geometric as well as non-geometric shapes. Though it is now more than a quarter of a century in the past, I recall vividly my encounter with Maria Reiche, the venerable Lady of the Lines, at her home in the town of Nazca, where she had lived since 1945, surrounded by the ancient geoglyphs that it was her fate to study, protect, and introduce to the world. She had recently celebrated her 90th birthday when Santa and I met her in June 1993. Although bedridden, with advanced Parkinsonism, her mind was sharp and her voice clear when she shared with us her own view of the significance of the lines. They teach us that our whole idea of the peoples of antiquity is wrong, that here in Peru was a civilization that was advanced, that had an advanced understanding of mathematics and astronomy, and that was a civilization of artists, expressing something unique about the human spirit for future generations to comprehend. I have already explored the mystery of Nazca in previous books, so I won't go over old ground here, except to note that among the most iconic of the Nazca geoglyphs, etched into the desert with a single unbroken line extending for more than a mile, and occupying an area of approximately 90 meters by 60 meters, is an image of a monkey. Its prehensile tail, stylized into a spiral, is a diagnostic feature of New World monkeys that distinguishes them from Old World monkeys. However, no monkeys have ever lived in the Nazca Desert. The nearest specimens, for example, capuchin monkeys, spider monkeys, and woolly monkeys, are all native to the Amazon rainforest. Another of the better-known Nazca geoglyphs looks like, and is usually referred to, as a spider. It has been suggested, however, that the huge 46-meter-long image arguably does not depict a spider, but a member of a closely related order of millimeter-sized arachnids, the tick spiders, called Dracinulae. More than 70 species have thus far been identified worldwide, not one of them in the Nazca Desert. Nor should we expect any there. Dracinulae favor tropical forests and caves, and the nearest populations of this very peculiar creature to Nazca are in the Brazilian Amazon, specifically in central, eastern, and southern Amazonia. There are many strange things about the Dracinulae order, but the strangest of all is a single feature that is regarded as its distinguishing anatomical characteristic. As described by Brazilian arachnologist Alexandre B. Bonaldo, this is its system of sperm transfer, which is achieved by an elaborate copulatory apparatus in the male third leg. Although barely a millimeter long and difficult to discern without magnification, it was first pointed out by the late Professor Gerald S. Hawkins of Boston University that this unusual reproductive extension, common to all Dracinulae species, is depicted in the correct place on the third leg of the Nazca spider. Hawkins, however, was an astronomer, while Bonaldo, a real expert on South American spiders, disagrees, remarking in emails we exchanged in October 2018, "The idea that the Nazca spider is a Dracinulae is kind of odd to me, since I always thought it was a mere mecomorphic spider such as the species of Myrmecium. Myrmecium is an exclusive South American genus, being recorded from the Venezuelan Caribbean to southern Brazil. But the majority of the species, 28 out of 38, are endemic to the Amazon basin, including lower parts of the Oriental Andean slopes in Peru, Ecuador, and Colombia." I asked if I could quote him on this, and he replied, "Sure, you can quote it if you want. I would add that that third leg modification shows no structures and is not bilateral. It appears to be just an extension of the drawing, as is common in other Nazca drawings." Bonaldo then kindly referred me to Arthur Anker, a colleague of his who specializes in macrophotography, and Anker in turn provided me with an image of Myrmecium from the Amazon. It is, in my view, a far better candidate for the Nazca spider than Dracinulae, and once again what it suggests to me is that scientists who observed nature closely were at work in ancient South America. but let's lower our sights and simply say that the monkey and spider figures, with their Amazonian provenance, call at the very least for a rethink of Shan's view that the Nazca lines and the Amazon geoglyphs are unconnected phenomena. Some facts and figures on the Amazonian geoglyphs. What is the general structure and appearance of the geoglyphs uncovered in the southwestern Amazon in recent decades? In their 2009 paper in Antiquity, Shan, Ranzi, and Parsonen give us this broad overview. In general, the geometric figures are formed by a ditch approximately 11 meters wide, currently 1 to 3 meters deep, with adjacent 0.5 to 1 meter high earthen banks formed by deposition of the excavated soil. Ring ditches have diameters that vary from 90 to 300 meters. When there are two or more structures, they are usually connected by embanked roads. Some of the single rectangular structures may have short roads coming out of their midsides or corners. Composite figures include a rectangle inside a circle, or vice versa. Some of the figures are quite roughly executed. Others are extremely exact, and in some cases an exact figure is combined with an inexact one in the same geoglyph, as at Santa Isabel, for example, where a large, well-made octagon is juxtaposed with an imprecise circle. By contrast, the geometrically austere Fazenda Parana site is comprised of two perfect squares, 200 meters and 100 meters wide, connected by a 20-meter-wide, 100-meter-long causeway. The two squares are further connected to straight roads leading east and west, north and south. More complex by far is the Fazenda Colorada site. Its geoglyphs consist of one circle, a quadrangle, and a double ditch structure, which forms a three-sided square. The three-sided square double ditch is connected to a trapezoidal structure comprised by linear walls without ditches. Its southwestern corner is open and connects to a roughly 55 meters broad avenue-like road. On both sides of the entrance, one can still see two high mounds standing like towers. The road has embankments which border both sides. And as it extends away from the entrance, it narrows, vanishing 600 meters further. Then consider the site known as Fazenda Atlantica. Here, the principal geoglyph forms a square, measuring 250 meters along each side. Quadrants are inscribed into the east and west corners, and a circle, 125 meters in diameter, connected to the square by a causeway 10 meters wide, lies 150 meters to the northwest. Defined by the avenue connecting the square and the circle, it is clear that the primary axis of Fazenda Atlantica runs northwest to southeast, an orientation that makes it a candidate for alignment to the setting sun on the June solstice and the rising sun on the December solstice. The listener will recall that Serpent Mound in Ohio is also aligned northwest to southeast to both these events. Its principal focus, signaled by its open jaws, is on the June solstice, midsummer in the northern hemisphere, where the serpent is located, and midwinter in the southern hemisphere, where the Amazonian geoglyphs are located. Without an archaeoastronomical survey, however, it is impossible to say whether or not the general northwest to southeast alignment of Fazenda Atlantica is solstitial, and if it is, whether any aspect of the site indicates priority given to one solstice over the other. A similar northwest to southeast orientation is seen at Tequino, another of the great Amazonian geoglyphs. When all its ancillary works were intact, it extended over an area of 15 hectares, 37 acres. What remains today are its two principal squares, the larger measuring 210 by 210 meters, with two further squares inscribed within it, and the smaller, which has suffered extensive damage, measuring 130 by 130 meters, and enclosing one further square. Defining the ruling northwest axis of the site, the main entrance to the larger square is 40 meters wide and opens onto a causeway 1.5 kilometers long. A proper survey will be required to establish whether or not there is any archaeoastronomical significance to the northwest orientation of Tequino's main entrance and causeway. What is already certain, however, is that a number of other Amazonian geoglyphs share the same general alignment. An example is Fazenda Ikiri 2, which combines a square earthwork measuring 140 meters along each side with an oval earthwork formed by 25 adjoining mounds. The long axis of this oval, paralleling the axis of the square, extends for 180 meters and is oriented to the northwest, making this site, too, a candidate for possible solstitial alignment if and when an archaeoastronomical survey is carried out. Another candidate is the partially destroyed site of Kokiral, which also consists of a series of adjoining mounds, of which 10 survive out of an original total of 18. The remaining mounds form a partial oval, with its long axis extending to approximately 100 meters, oriented to the northwest. As with Tekino, as with Fazenda Ikiri II, and as with Fazenda Atlantica, a proper survey will be required before any possible archaeoastronomical significance of the Kokiral oval could be investigated. Indeed, as I review the otherwise excellent science so far dedicated to the Amazonian earthworks, it is evident that the most serious and consequential lapse, which must be remedied if further progress is to be made, concerns this consistent blindness to possible archaeoastronomical connections. Not a single one of the many papers on the geoglyphs reviewed in this chapter has a word to say about astronomical alignments, and so far as I am aware at the time of writing, not one of the leading scholars has shown any interest in investigating the possibility that such alignments might exist. Ironically, however, the same scholars all agree. The geometric earthworks were constructed on carefully selected elevated yet level surfaces. Their location on interfluvial plateau provided good visible control over the surrounding terrain. The carefully planned position of the earthworks in the landscape and the recurring geometric forms represented in earthwork architecture suggest functions that were part of a tradition of shared collective ideology related to the cosmology and/or socio-political concerns of the ancient peoples. The irony is that there's an important clue here, hidden in plain sight. It's true that the choice of elevated locations, giving good visible control over the surrounding terrain, could have something to do with the socio-political concerns of the ancient peoples. But because they offer an unobstructed view of the horizon, such locations are also very often what ancient astronomers looked for when they set out monuments on the ground, aligned, say, to the June solstice sunset or to the March equinox sunrise. Perhaps it's partly in recognition of this that the passage cited above includes a token reference to cosmology. But token references are not enough. Without a full-scale archaeoastronomical survey of the Amazonian geoglyphs, we are, in my opinion, unlikely ever to get to grips with the full range of challenges and opportunities that they represent. An ever-receding horizon. How old are the geoglyphs? In 2009, only a single carbon date had been established for the entire area surveyed, then 250 kilometers across, and constituting 200 known sites with over 210 geometric structures. The date was from Fazenda, Colorado, and had proved to be quite recent, around 750 years before the present, but with a margin of error that the investigators chose to average at AD 1283, a date they believed to be representative of a number of sites, since Fazenda Colorado exhibits much of the variability seen for the region. This date, they declare, implies a late occupation, only around 300 years before the Europeans' arrival, but is consistent with the development of complex societies in other areas of the Amazon between AD 900 and 1400. As we've seen so often with archaeology, new discoveries can change everything. And after just three more seasons of excavation, Ramsey, Shan, and Parsonen were singing a very different song. In a follow-up paper to their 2009 study published in the Journal of Field Archaeology in 2012, they reported a greatly expanded survey area, now encompassing roughly 25,000 square kilometers. Within it, 281 enclosures, formed by continuous ditches, in most cases surrounding a perfectly geometric inner plaza with an area of 1 to 3 hectares, had been found in various shapes, chiefly circles, ellipses, rectangles, and squares. Then came the first dynamite revelation. Fazenda Colorada had been thoroughly re-excavated, and 5 additional radiocarbon samples, collected from different stratigraphic levels, were analyzed. Again, there are margins of error with carbon-14 dating, but the bottom line is that the previous date of AD 1283, while fitting with preconceptions about when and where complex societies developed in the Amazon, was found to have been taken from organic materials deposited very late in the life of the site. What the new samples indicated was that Fazenda Colorada had been consistently occupied from as early as AD 25 until around the end of the 14th century. Organic materials from a number of other geoglyph sites were also excavated and dated, showing a similar profile. And the overall conclusion of the investigators across all the sites was that these new radiocarbon dates place the initial stage of earthwork construction as early as 2,000 years before the present. In summary, therefore, just 3 years of research between 2009 and 2012 witnessed a profound change in archaeological understanding of the geoglyphs of the southwestern Amazon. Previously, they'd been thought to be just 750 years old. Now, without any real attention being drawn to the implications, they'd become 2,000 years old. To put this in context, an error and subsequent correction on a similar scale would certainly attract a great deal of attention if it concerned Western architecture. Indeed, it would be like discovering that the great Gothic cathedrals of Europe, such as Chartres and York Minster, were not in fact works of the late medieval period, but had actually been built by the Romans. What are we to conclude concerning mistakes of such magnitude, and the tendency of archaeologists to reach and propagate premature conclusions based on limited samples? For instance, the single AD 1283 date from Fazenda Colorada being allowed to stand for 3 years without corroboration as representative of a number of sites. And similarly, at Serpent Mound in Ohio, where in 2018 a date of around AD 1000 was still being touted in official notices, despite firm carbon-14 evidence on the public record since 2014 that the structure is more than 1,000 years older than that. Listeners will make up their own minds, but the uncertainty and the constant failure of old models, such as Clovis I in North America and Megger's counterfeit paradise dogma about the Amazon, do not fill me with confidence about much else that this discipline has to say. In particular, I'm not persuaded by the new consensus that the geoglyphs of the southwestern Amazon are 2,000 years old. Other carbon-14 dates mentioned in the 2012 report already hint at a more complicated picture. Take the site known as Severino Calazans, for example. Curiously, the square geoglyph the archaeologists excavated here has the same massive footprint, measuring 230 meters along each side, as the Great Pyramid of Egypt. Both monuments are also cardinally oriented, that is, their sides face the cardinal directions, north, south, east, and west. 2 carbon-14 dates from Severino Calazans were cited by Ranzi, Shan, and Parsonen as further confirmation that the Amazonian geoglyph project began about 2,000 years ago. Margins of error apply, but these dates were 159 BC from excavation Unit 3 and 171 BC from Unit 6B. Fitting much less comfortably into the new hypothesis, however, were the 2 other dates from Severino Calazans. Again, there are margins of error, but these dates were respectively 1,211 BC from Unit 5 and 2577 BC from Unit 3, the latter suggesting that this geoglyph might not only have the same footprint as the Great Pyramid of Egypt, but might also be about the same age. We've seen how the existence of true civilizations in the Amazon before European contact has been cautiously embraced by archaeologists in recent years. Even so, few would yet be willing to accept that any Amazonian civilization worthy of the name might have existed as early as 2577 BC, and certainly not one well organized and motivated enough to create a cardinally oriented geoglyph on the grand scale of Severino Calasanz, where the full perimeter, defined by an enclosure ditch 12 meters wide, measures 920 meters, more than 3,000 feet. Unsurprisingly, therefore, Ranzishan and Parthenon conclude that the date of 2577 BC is probably unrelated to the time of initial construction of the earthworks. All they're prepared to concede is that this date suggests early human activity at the site. They perhaps stick their necks out further than most of their peers would when they allow the possibility that the second anomalous date from Severino Calasanz, 1211 BC, may be related to earthwork construction. But what is the logic of this? If we have dispensed with our former assertion that a date of AD 1283 was somehow representative of the geoglyphs in general, and if we're going to allow a possible start on this great regional project as early as 1211 BC, then why should we be unable to contemplate an even earlier start as far back as 2577 BC? Since so little of the Amazon has been surveyed by archaeologists, and since no theory about the character and constraints of its past cultures and civilizations has been able to explain all the data, it would surely be wiser to keep an open mind. Besides, as Ranzi, Parthenon, and Shan themselves point out, they are working with a very limited sample of the potential data. Parthenon at one point estimated that as many as 1,500 geoglyphs might ultimately be found. And the authorities are in general agreement that these earthworks, uncovered by modern deforestation, represent only a fraction of the total, which lie undiscovered beneath the intact seasonal southern Amazonian rainforests. It is therefore perfectly possible that multiple other sites, as yet unknown to archaeologists, will be discovered in the years to come. They might confirm the existing archaeological model that the geoglyphs are about 2,000 years old, or they might turn out to reinforce that anomalous date of 2577 BC, or who knows, they might even provide much older dates and reveal more sophisticated constructions. Once again, whatever the facts are on the ground, we won't know for sure unless we look. Curiosities. It's a curiosity. I claim nothing more at this point, that the square enclosure ditch at Severino Calasanz shares the ground plan, base dimensions, and cardinality of the Great Pyramid of Egypt, as well as a carbon date from the epoch of the Great Pyramid. That epoch, moreover, around 2500 BC, coincides and overlaps with the megalithic epoch in Europe. So another curiosity is the way that the circular geoglyphs of Amazonia resemble henges, the circular embankments with deep internal ditches that surround the great stone circles of the British Isles. The scale is very similar, and the resemblance is so obvious that even the most sober archaeologists, usually wary of cross-cultural comparisons, are willing to remark upon it. For example, Dr. Jennifer Watling of the Museum of Archaeology and Ethnography at the University of Sao Paulo, author of an important study of the Amazonian earthworks published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in February 2017, states frankly that the characteristics of the circular geoglyphs with their embankments and ditches are what classically describe henge sites. The earliest phases at Stonehenge consisted of a similarly laid out enclosure. It is likely that the geoglyphs were used for similar functions to the Neolithic causeways enclosures, in other words, public gathering, ritual sites. A point of order here. A henge is a prehistoric earthwork formed by a circular embankment surrounding a ditch. Usually the embankment is heaped up from the soil removed to create the ditch. This is the case, for example, at the causewayed enclosure of Avebury, Europe's largest henge, which has a diameter of approximately 420 meters. Walking briskly, it takes about half an hour to make a complete circuit of the lip of the Avebury embankment, from which you look down across the ditch at the immense circular inner plaza that the ditch defines. Disposed at intervals around the outer perimeter of this plaza, set back a couple of meters from its edge, a complete ring of giant megaliths once stood in antiquity, encompassing two other stone circles placed side by side. Very few of the original megaliths now remain, the site having been used as a quarry in later times. But although Avebury's causeways are almost entirely gone, the henge is still there, and it is still possible to make out the form of the great stone circle that it encloses and the remnants of the paired inner circles. What cannot now be seen, but was discovered in 2017 by archaeologists using ground-penetrating radar, is the square formation, measuring 30 meters along each side, again defined by a perimeter of standing stones, that once occupied the center of the southernmost of the two inner circles. Strangely enough, at a site called Jacossá in the Amazon, we also find a geoglyph in which a circle and square are combined. But here it is the square that encloses the circle. The square sides, report Ransi Shan and their colleagues, are 140 meters long, while the external embankment is 12 meters wide and 1.6 meters high. The circle contains an internal embankment and is 100 meters in diameter. This mention of embankments raises a more general point. Though Avebury is a true henge, Stonehenge, despite its name, technically is not. This is because its original great circular ditch was cut outside, not inside its embankment. As Jennifer Watling remarks, it's interesting to note that some of the Amazonian geoglyphs have this same format, with an outer ditch. Some, like Jacossá, have both. As with the British henges, however, so with the Amazon. Ransi Shan and Parsonen confirm that the ditches of the Amazonian geoglyphs are usually situated inside the embankments. A Global Legacy. Jennifer Watling's paper, co-authored with Denise Shan, Alceo Ransi, and others, describes circular geoglyphs of the Amazon with ditches up to 11 meters wide, 4 meters deep, and 100 to 300 meters in diameter. The authors argue that these sites, some of which have up to 6 enclosures, rival the most impressive examples of pre-Columbian monumental architecture anywhere in the Americas. Their excavations found an almost complete absence of cultural material within the enclosed areas. They conclude that the earthworks were built and used sporadically as ceremonial and public gathering sites between 2000 and 650 calibrated years before the present, but that some may have been constructed as early as 3,500 to 3,000 years before the present. I emphasize the last point about the early dates for two reasons. First, because they're given in the paper at all. What we have here is a group of mainstream archaeologists sticking their necks out a little bit further in the pages of a prestigious journal on what, until now, would have been thought of as an impossible achievement for Amazonian societies 3,500 years ago. Second, these same archaeologists are still being cautious. The period of 3,500 to 3,000 years before the present that they're prepared to entertain for the construction of at least some of the geoglyphs corresponds with Unit 5 at Severino Calazans, where a sample yielded a date within the usual margins of error of 1211 BC. The paper makes no mention, however, of the other much earlier date of 2577 BC that was retrieved from Unit 3, the date that coincides with the epoch of Stonehenge, Avebury, and the Great Pyramid of Egypt. Before I go further, let me reiterate a key point about which it is important to be absolutely clear. It is not my purpose here to insinuate that the Amazonian geoglyphs were in any way inspired by Britain's stone circles, or by the Great Pyramid of Egypt, or by other known Old World monuments, or for that matter, vice versa. Where there are similarities, my suggestion is that it might be more fruitful to look for their origins in a remote ancestral civilization that passed down a common inheritance all around the globe, an inheritance of knowledge, an inheritance of science, an inheritance of earth measuring, that was then put into practice in many different environments by the many different cultures receiving it. In some, the inheritance may have been rejected at the outset, or subsequently frittered away and lost. In others, as millennia passed, locally originated differences in expression multiplied to such an extent that they often almost completely obscured the underlying genetic connections to a remote common ancestor. Nonetheless, dig deep enough, and those connections, like recessive genes, sooner or later make themselves felt. Not all the henges of the British Isles contain stone circles. Many are simply gigantic earthworks, like the geoglyphs of the southwestern Amazon. No megalithic monuments have yet been found in the Brazilian state of Acre, where the geoglyphs proliferate, perhaps because of a lack of good natural materials, or perhaps because so much of the area has yet to be properly surveyed. There are stone circles in the Amazon, however, as we shall hear in the next chapter.